To be alive, to be happy, to be stimulated is also to be challenged and troubled and turmoiled. There's much that you can do to be happy, but what I want to emphasize today is that this fellowship, being a part of this fellowship, will make anything you do to make you happier, to make you happy, even more happy. This fellowship can make you happier. I heard a woman, a story about a woman who was trying to figure out how to be happy. She's an old woman. She lived in an assisted living apartment building. In front, they had a little garden with a koi pond that she often just walked by with some benches there. But one day, she sees an old, wrinkled old guy she's never seen before. And he's sitting there, and he's just beaming, radiant with happiness. And she just stops, and she says, "Excuse me, but I can't help but notice how happy you look." And he goes, "I am happy." She said, "Wow." She said, "Life is so hard and there's so many difficulties, especially as we get older, it gets harder and harder to be happy. What is your secret?" And he said, "Well, I eat all the fattening foods I want. I avoid any difficult exercise. I calm myself with cigarettes every hour, and I drink lots and lots of whiskey." She looks at him, and she seems completely sincere, and she thinks about that for a second. She goes, "Well, if you don't mind asking, how old are you now?" And he said, "Oh, well, last week I just turned 38. It's hard to be happy. There seem to be all sorts of things that we can do that somehow don't end up being what we want. But the idea that you can be happy and that this fellowship can make you happier came to me as I was listening to an interview with a Canadian author and speaker, Neil Pasricha. Pasricha is most famous for a blog and a book entitled The Book of Awesome. He also recently wrote another book called The Happiness Equation, and he founded the Institute for Global Happiness. In the interview, he was speaking about, especially when people transition from a work life or they have work into retirement, and he said there are these four elements of happiness, what he called the four S's, that were essential for your well-being, and often people lose them as they go through that transition. He was talking about how important they were. But as I was listening to him, I thought how UU congregations, about how this fellowship not only offer these things, but we offer them in truckloads, and we also offer them in an amazing, integrated, powerful way that enhances their power in everybody's life. We offer story and stimulation and structure and society. Now, I want to note that the words like happiness or well-being or joy or gladness, all those words, pleasure, they're all rather mushy words, and they're rather hard to define clearly, especially hard to define scientifically. And I was very distracted by this fact as I was thinking about the sermon until I found this 19th century writer. She's a writer of novels and nonfiction. Her name was Dinah Craik. Religiously, she's what they called a nonconformist, which meant she did not conform with the Church of England. But at one point, she said, "I'm really not a church lady." She knew some Unitarians. They knew her. In a book called A Woman's Thoughts About Women, she wrote, she was writing about happiness. "I fear the inevitable conclusion we must all come to is this, that in the world, happiness is quite indefinable. We can no more grasp it than we can grasp the sun in the sky or the moon in the water. We can feel it interpenetrating our whole being with warmth and strength. We can see it in a pale reflection shining elsewhere. Or in its total absence, we, walking in darkness, learn to appreciate what it is by what it is not." So given that we don't know exactly what well-being is and happiness are, I want to hold up Mr. Pasricha's ideas that it does appear through four key elements. And the first of those is social, society, relationships. Social relationships, we know, we have seen this repeated over and over again, they have a greater effect on our happiness than our house, our income, our cars, our travel. All these things we think might make us happy will not make us happy if we do not have people that we care about to share them with, if we do not share them with people that we value. The show Hidden Brain yesterday explored on NPR explored the causes of social isolation, especially amongst men. Coyote is an exemplar of the loner who does not make enduring connections. And the show talked about men who have the complete capability of making friends and then lose that ability over time. We know that mental health depends not only on the good chemistry of our own individual bodies, mental health depends not only on our own brain structures and biology, but on the biology and the social connections and the networks all around us. And people speak about how mental health is essential in turning away gun violence. I would like to see them nurturing good social networks and resources, nurture mental health. Exercising your ability to do friendships, being learned and trained on how to build friendships and build community with others to make lasting relationships is as important on your physical health as is physical exercise. And it can be difficult, as the song held up so clearly. It can be difficult and troubling and problematic and mess up your sleep. And yet, it adds to our happiness more than anything else. I loved raising my children in a UU congregation because then they not only had two grandmothers, but they had 10 grandmothers or 20 grandfathers, uncles and aunts, hundreds of them, all surrounding them, caring about them, sharing their lives. One great source of stress in my life recently has been the disruptions of moving every year or so and having to leave good friends behind. Good thing for me, though, is that wherever I go, I know there's a Unitarian Universalist congregation to welcome me, and I really want to affirm how good you have been at welcoming me into your community, of being friendly to me, of being generous to me. And you do that for one another. Keep finding the people who need so desperately community, the people who cannot so easily find this congregation. Find those people and invite them in. And it's stimulating to be around people. We have interesting people in the congregation, people of all different resources and strengths. And that brings me to the second S, which is stimulation. Pastor Richa says it's essential to be challenged, to learn new things, to feel yourself growing, to get new ideas. We UUs have understood this for centuries. Our very theology emphasizes open revelation, the exploration of truth, the growth of knowledge and understanding, the importance of growing our understanding, seeking new understanding through character and developing our character and developing our personalities, developing our strengths, and always learning something new, the things that we are very good at. Sometimes maybe we need to go try things that we're not so good at. I have a story that talks about this. Great illustration about how both the stimulation and social work together. There's a man named Lowell. Lowell had been raised in a working class family. His father had been a barber, so he became a barber. He did okay in school, but he knew wasn't going to really help him. He got his high school degree, but he loved to read. He really loved learning about things, and school wasn't really teaching him anything interesting. But he was always reading, and he liked in the conversations that he would have in the barbershop, sometimes he could find someone who was interested in things European history. He loved European history, and he was raised within a Christian church, and he loved Christian history to learn the dynamics of how things developed and how it grew. And he kept looking for people that would have this conversation with him. It took him decades to finally find the Unitarian Universalists, and he realized that these people not only knew about things, but liked to talk about things. And so he went to the UU church for intellectual stimulation. The sermons would be stimulating. The conversation afterwards would be stimulating. And then one day, he was walking up the stairs to his one-room apartment. And this is a working-class guy, one-room apartment, and he cannot get up the stairs. And he falls to the stairs in exhaustion, and the ambulance comes, and they take him to the hospital, and they diagnose him with congestive heart failure. And luckily, he's got enough in Medicare, and Medicaid is helping him out. But what he suddenly realized that he had not understood before came from the people who started to visit. He started counting all the people who visited him and the people who left him cards. He lost track somewhere about 32. He began to understand that the fellowship was not simply a place for intellectual stimulation. It had been a community all along, and he had not understood that. He had not understood the power and the importance of that community until he needed it desperately, and it was there for him without his asking. He had given sermons, this high school educated odd duck, had given sermons to university professors and lawyers, never understanding the connections that he was making. He would learn something new all of a sudden. He learned something new from those people that he hadn't expected to learn. And part of the reason that it's powerful to learn from a community is to find purpose. Neil Patricia uses the word structure. He talks about what gives you structure, like the way your skeleton gives your body structure. Without your skeleton, you're a jellyfish. What is it that gives your life a sense of structure? And he talks about this in terms of you have a third of your day should be given to sleep, and a third of your day should be given to essential tasks. And then you got the whole another third of your day that should be devoted to what is your passion, to what makes it worthy to do the other two-thirds of your day. What is it that makes you want to get up? He holds up that Japanese word from Okinawa, ikigai. Ikigai is your reason for being alive. And it can be something that you do that you know is important. He talked about fishermen who understood that they were nurturing the life of their community and that they did it well and they loved doing that work. He talked about one elderly woman who, for whom her purpose in life, her ikigai, was to see her grandchild smile. Not always, but she looked for those moments where she could see that smile again, and she knew that she was living day to day. The reason she wanted to get up the next day was so she could see that smile yet again. For me, I was like the quote by the Dalai Lama who said, "I believe the very purpose of life is to be happy. From every core of our being, we desire contentment. And the key to that is developing inner peace. But for me, it goes a little beyond that. For me, it's helping UU congregations, Unitarian Universalist congregations, be healthy and vibrant and reaching out to more people and helping more people live well on this good earth." We have statements of purpose. It's interesting. I went to the website of this congregation, mission and purpose, mission statement page, and it says we don't really have a mission statement. We have a number of statements. And there's the statements of we have the purposes of the Unitarian Universalist Association, which are the seven of those. But then there's UUA has six sources, each of which is really a purpose statement and a source combined. There are many other statements that we use in this congregation. But of course, each week we repeat over and over again that we want to dwell in peace. We want to seek knowledge and freedom. We want to help one another in fellowship. And we sing, we want to move in the hand, giving life the shape of justice. This gives structure to our community. Each individual person, whatever it is that brings us alive, whether it's shaping pots or working on the website, it's connected to other people's sense of purpose, and we begin to find the way in which our purpose brings us together and gives structure to all of our lives. And that's how we find the fourth S, which is the story. People use different words for the story. Some people may use the word God to talk about the source of the story or the shaping power of the story. Other people may use the word dharma or truth. I heard a story the other day about a woman named Sirle Tatis Arzuza. She's in Colombia, born in Colombia, raised in Colombia. And she, as a little child, was bullied. She was bullied as a little child because she had natural Afro-Caribbean hair. Now, I don't know if any of you are aware of this, but of all the people who were imported from Africa into slavery in the Americas, only 3% went into the continental United States. The 97% of all the people who were shipped out of Africa into slavery came into the Caribbean and into Central America. This is a place of color. And people of color are everywhere. And yet the ideas of racism, the ideas that reinforced the chattel system of chattel slavery, still are vibrant and alive. And in Colombia, if you have natural, nappy, curly hair, you will be associated with gangsters or with idiots. You will be degraded. And so she was, as a little child, was degraded. Until her mother started straightening her hair with harsh chemicals, dangerous chemicals. And suddenly, she became popular. Suddenly, she became successful. And I contrast that story with the story of Bill Sinkford. Bill Sinkford grew up in Cincinnati. And he knew what it was like to be a mixed race person in America. He knew what it was like to be a black person in America, to be degraded and told that part of who you were was not worthy, just as Sirle had been told that she was not worthy. And then in 1960, as a young black man, I walked into First Unitarian Cincinnati. I knew I had found my religious community where I could be fully myself. Now, I don't know if any of you know about race in Unitarian Universalist Association. 1968 was a miserable year. We really failed miserably. And in the 70s, he felt like we had turned our back, the Universalists had turned our back on racial justice, and he went off into the corporate world and wandered for a while doing corporate work until he had two children. And he realized that he wanted his children to be happy and that his children would be more happy if they had a religious home. And so he came back into Unitarian Universalist Congregation and slowly he began to see its power. And when one of his children was deathly ill, the congregation and the messages and the stories that linked his own fear and grief into a greater story, both of grief and of hope, of struggle and of hope, made sure that he got religion, and he became ordained as a Unitarian Universalist leader, and then he became the first black man to lead a traditionally white organization in the United States of America from 2001 to 2008. He was president of our association. And then when we had some troubles, again around issues of race, he returned in 2017 to serve briefly with others as co-president. Now imagine Sirle. This Colombian woman, if as a child, as that little seven-year-old child, instead of being told that she was worthless who she was, she had been in a Unitarian Universalist congregation, in a congregation that told her that she was not only pretty, just as she was, but that she had the power of three continents in her blood. That she had the power of Europe and Spain in her blood. She had the power of Africa in her blood. She had the power of Central America in her blood. She was powerful. Imagine that little girl, instead of being poisoned with chemicals and as a young adult finding her hair falling out and realizing that she had been not only given bad chemicals, but given a terrible lie that was eating away at her soul. If she had been given the message of a whole community of people that stimulated her, that gave her connections and culture and helped her move forward and showed her the purpose of her life, she had to find her purpose. Today, she's known as La Reina de Pelo Bueno, the Queen of Good Hair. But she's not just nurturing hair. She's starting to see that her life is a part of undoing the destructive power of racism in the entire Western Hemisphere. She is starting to make connections. If only those connections had been planted in her as a child. So I encourage you in this congregation to feel happy about being here. As we heard this morning, someone said, I'm glad to be here. I'm happy to be a part of this community. When you find a community that's stimulating and structuring, social and passionate and meaningful, when you find a community of that sort, wow, you have found the way in which the story of your individual life, all the things that are happening to you, become connected. And you begin to see that you are part of the awakening of all humanity. The movement of the spirit of justice, the movement of the spirit of life, are just simply the human spirit waking up on this earth, moving towards that great dream of the human community, the beloved community, undefinable and yet as beautiful as the moon in the water, as the sun beyond our reach. Happiness. Justice and deep happiness.